Hello and welcome to the Brand My Career podcast. I'm your host, Alex Cutterford, and I'm so glad you're joining me today. My goal is to help you take ownership of your career, find your people through personal branding and networking, and take career-enhancing action. Managing your life and career can be hard. That's why every fortnight I'll be releasing an episode where I interview a diverse range of guests that will help you find clarity and build confidence in your career. Let's get into it.
Well, welcome back to another episode of the Brand My Career podcast. And today I have Marianne Powell with me. Thank you so much for being on.
You are very welcome. Thanks for having me, Alex. We've already had a little bit of a riff offline, so I'm excited to see where we go with this group flow in today's conversation.
Yeah, I thought we better start recording because otherwise we're gonna miss out on all the good banter that we're chucking around here with dogs running around and forgetting to prepare for podcasts and,
absolutely,
and all of the fun things. But so excited to have you on. I had the pleasure of being at the Hunter Innovation Festival back in September, which you emceed and did such a fantastic job of.
Thank you.
And I was already following you on LinkedIn and but didn't get a chance to catch you on the day and thought, oh, I better reach out to Marianne and just say hi and thank you for the amazing job you did, because I think one of the things that you bring to a room or a space, I guess, is this ability to really draw people in and keep people present in the moment. And I just thought it was, really amazing.
Oh, Alex, that's really kind of you. Thank you for sharing. It felt like a really significant year this year. I've done the Hunter Innovation Festival. It's my third year this year, actually. And the director, who's actually, it was his last year of being a director, so that could have played part of it. But he and I sat down, Alex, and said, you know, what is it? What's the energy that we really want to invite people into? And it felt like it was around reflection and connection. Mm-hmm. And really honest and raw, vulnerable conversations. So I appreciate your feedback, because it was quite intentional that we wanted to create a space where people felt like they could genuinely connect and let their guards down a little bit and feel safe to do so. So it wasn't the normal rah-rah maz that people are used to seeing on stage. There were no dancing monkey performances, I must admit. It felt really special. I think this year's it's been big for lots of people for a lot of reasons. There's a lot happening in our world.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, it was definitely a 2024 highlight. It's good to be with you today.
Yeah, awesome. So you do lots of things. You're a clinical psychologist, executive coach, consultant, speaker. So you're one of those ones where it's hard to do an intro for, because it's like, well, like, should I just say what you don't do or...
I love that. Oh, my word. This is my favorite podcast recording already. I relate. You know, try being me explaining what I do. I've come to the realization, though, I think a passionate, creative, multi-hyphenate probably best describes me. And my basis and my why or my purpose has always been, and how these things link together, it's always been around reducing, and I say my big why or my moonshot goal is to eliminate unnecessary human suffering. And I say unnecessary because I think that there is human suffering that is important, that helps us to move through initiations and to really understand ourselves and move towards, you know, a concept that in psychology we refer to as self-actualization. That's kind of become my area of fascination and interest in terms of psychology. So that purpose is, you know, reduce unnecessary suffering, but then also to help people activate their potential. And so, you know, how I do that and in what ways I show up across the world and you know, how I deliver that message, that's just the medium. You know, it's like being a creative. If you're an artist, you might use watercolors, you might use pencils, you might use clay, but you're creating art and you're hoping to shift conversations and make change. And I guess if I'm really pushed and I'm really asked to identify what it is I do in the world, I always resort back to saying that I'm a creative. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, no, that's really good. I've actually, and I really want to dive into creativity with you today.
One of my favorite topics.
Through some of the things you've written about and things to think through what we could chat about, and I'm keen to dive into the new neurodiversity conversation and
awesome,
and even try and understand some of that language that's moving around there to really, because what I was noticing was I was reading something and thinking I understood what that meant, but I was realizing, oh, that's just a quick assumption that I've made of what that term means or things like that. So I was keen to dig into that a bit. But then diving into leadership and then that creativity, because for me, I've identified creativity as a value of mine, not just something that I like to do, but something that I actually is a quite a core value in that I've, because I always find myself going back, if I'm not able to be in a space of creativity, then I'm probably not feeling like I'm at my best, or I'm probably not operating at my best. And life is just so much more enjoyable when you're in that state of creativity. So, really keen to dive into it.
You can see me scrambling for a pen, because that is just the most beautiful thing I think I have heard all week, and I need to write it down, that creativity is a core value. Do you know, I don't think I've ever heard anybody describe it like that. And it's, as you're saying that, I guess my word association is going, yeah, similarly for me, it's like a life force. You know, if I don't have access to be able to express myself in the world, then it really does negatively impact on my well-being. So it's more than a verb, isn't it? And it's more than a title, being a creative. Yeah. It's a way of being in the world. I love that. Creativity as a core value. You need to label that. You need to put that on t-shirts. It's going everywhere. It's going everywhere. Alex says.
You think like me, everything that I think about is in a quote that could go on a t-shirt.
Absolutely. It's all about the merch. Yeah. I'm also curious, because, you know, one of the other hats I play, as you know, is as a podcast hat. So I have to be careful to remember that I'm the guest. But you mentioned that you had some assumptions that you have sort of clocked yourself on when you were reading through. I'm so curious to hear what those assumptions were. Let's dive into some of the questions you had.
Yeah. So I guess... So the question around neurodiversity. So what is, like, neuro, you'd written something talking about neuroaffirming performance psychology coaching.
Huh. Yeah.
And I heard that and I just sort of read it and kept reading. And it's not necessarily that I was drawing these really strong conclusions, but I was just reading it as if I knew what I was hearing. And then then realizing, actually, I don't even know if I've heard that term before, but I've heard all of these different words. Like I have an idea of what coaching someone is. I have an idea of what psychology is. I have an idea of what it means to be neuroaffirming. And so I heard those things and this went, oh, yeah, like that's you're doing things in a way that is appropriate for a neurodiverse person.
Beautiful. Spot on.
But there's more to be unpacked though.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I like that we're double clicking on language though, because it really does matter. I think there's some split conversations in the neurodivergent community and also with allies and people asking, you know, well, does it matter as long as we're all talking? And I would say first and foremost, the talking part is the important part, so having these conversations. And I'd hate to see language be a barrier to stop conversations. And at the same time, you know, the more that I've learned and lent into the community, I've begun to recognize that there are, historical terms that are really triggering for some people, that bring up biases and assumptions that are very ableist, that, you know, assume very what we would say as neuronormative ways or neurotypical ways of thinking, that really don't invite neurodivergent people in a way that feels inviting and safe and compassionate and curious and all those beautiful human qualities that we want to be able to have changed. So yeah, language does matter. So thanks for clicking on it. And the term neuroaffirming, you are right. I've begun to use it more and more so because my landscape of interest and work is really is sitting more in the space of helping neurodivergent people to thrive. So I've, you know, had a career of looking at the vulnerable aspects of our community and supporting, you know, that clinical psychology space. And I still do work a lot with burnout and some more of those struggles or the suffering. But I'm also a big believer that unless we look at the strengths in our community and look at what it takes to go from functioning to flourishing, then we're missing out on a lot of the potential. We're capping ourselves. And so neuroaffirming approaches, whether they be through a therapy or through conversations, whether they be in the clinical landscape with suffering and treatment, or whether they be in that functioning to flourishing and thriving aspect, it's really about recognizing the lived experience of a neurodivergent person, recognizing that a lot of our treatment protocol, and if you're not watching this, I'm using like my little fingers to do commas, the treatment protocol to fix us, which we now know isn't really appropriate, has been really damning and damaging for our communities. So affirming is more appreciating that we do have brain-based differences and that they're to be respected and acknowledged and cherished.
Because I was actually having the shower thought this morning about this as I was realizing, there's a whole another angle that I've forgotten about. And it was, I was thinking about, because on your profile you say you're a proud ADHDer.
Yeah.
And I was thinking back to, and because I'm, you know, following people like yourself and Julie Cockrell and people that are having really positive conversations around this, it's easy then to make the assumption, the narrative has changed. But then also recognizing, okay, well, actually, there's probably still a more broader conversation that hasn't shifted as much as the people that I'm following. And I was thinking back to when I was at school and you're aware, like in language around ADHD was being used. But when I think about people that were labeled ADHD, it was people that were typically from a lower socioeconomic demographic were the only people that you really heard of or talked about in that way. And troublemakers, you know, people that were a bit off the rails and couldn't be contained.
Identify with that second one. Yeah, go on.
But it was through a negative lens, though. Yeah, like it was perceived as a negative lens. And so then I was just thinking that, like, that whole experience of, like, there are still people walking around, like, with those labels and those the negative stigma that's attached to it.
Yeah. 100%. You're spot on. And it's why I do get out and bang on the drum a lot, because for me, getting a diagnosis has been a game changer. So mine was a late diagnosis in my late 30s. It coincided with perimenopause and good old COVID, where the wheels really fell off. But I'm not your typical ADHD presentation that I learned about in clinical psychology, right? My two kids are more typical in their presentations. So my boy in particular, my girl wasn't diagnosed until she was 14, and she actually had to self-advocate for that diagnosis because she was more of the inattentive type. So I've learned a lot about neurodivergence through my kids. But my own diagnosis, it took 3 GPs to say, nope. It was a fourth one that would entertain it. But 3 GPs who said, nope, there ain't no way that you can have ADHD because you've got a master's degree and you're a clinical psychologist, and it's not possible for somebody with ADHD to achieve that level of success, which was so interesting to me because we know that ADHD is not associated at all with intelligence. It doesn't impact intelligence. We might express our intelligence in the world in a very different way because of our communication differences, because of our working memory differences. But it's certainly, it's not indicative factor or a feature for diagnostic purposes. And yet that stigma still holds. So we're really only, I think, starting to scratch the surface of understanding the stories that have been lost. And actually, you know, neurodivergent adults are referring to themselves as the lost generation. So when you hear of people saying, everybody's going out and getting an ADHD diagnosis or an autism diagnosis, it's actually not true. In Australia, we're undershooting. I shared some statistics recently if you're interested in hearing them. But, I mean, the World Health Organization pitches that for adult ADHD, we can anticipate between sort of 2.8 and up to 6% of representation. In Australia in 2018, we were sitting at 0.2%. of diagnosis for adult ADHD. So when you read the headlines in 2023 that ADHD diagnosis has doubled since 2018 or pre-COVID, you do the maths. We've got a lot of work to do because there's a lot of people who are otherwise thinking of their brain-based differences like I was as personal flaws. And all that does is cap your potential and, again, add to that unnecessary suffering that I'm so interested in moving the needle on.
Yeah. Because that was the other thing I was thinking about terms that you hear, so is people saying, everyone's got an ADHD diagnosis these days. Which I guess does point to the fact that there is an increased advocation and conversation, which is a good thing. It's just obviously those conversations then bring everything to the forefront and it creates a grappling, and you get society grappling with this, and so those people, at least they've been exposed to that conversation, and some may eventually come around to seeing what is the point of the conversation.
Yeah. And I think that it's a, you know, I'm someone who sort of doesn't think necessarily in dichotomous ways that it's this or that. There's very genuine reason as to why people are asking about why is ADHD all of a sudden so noisy. And, you know, I guess professionally I've thought a lot about this and I've done some reading. I think that we've come through a little bit of a season just recently in the last 5 years where lots of things are happening at the same time. So we're seeing a rise in social activism, which is, you know, in my opinion, a really good thing, but a rise in female voices, a rise in recognition that actually as women, we've got a lot of things that we can share and give in the world, but the workforce isn't necessarily designed around our natural ways of being. And so what's really interesting is that some of the voices that are speaking up and some of the people who are searching these terms like hashtag ADHD on TikTok, they're predominantly women. Mm. And if you look at the stage and seasons of life in which women are searching for answers because they are struggling with, perhaps it's with cognition, perhaps it's with memory, perhaps it's with their confidence. I think the other piece of the conversation is that we're forgetting is that perimenopause, which is through, you know, the years of as early for me, it hit at 37, but right up to sort of 54, that age bracket for 10 years of a woman's life, the changes in her estrogen levels do impact her cognitive function to the point where it can mimic the symptoms of ADHD. So people are looking for answers and they're wanting to be able to step into health. And I think that's a really great thing. That we're asking and having these conversations. Where I'd like to see things shift and change is to help people in psychology, we'd call it differential diagnosis. So to help people understand that if you've got cognitive challenges going on, you've got irritability, you've got frustration, you've got loss of memory that can happen with perimenopause and menopause. But it can also happen with a bunch of other things like stress. It can happen with physical health issues. And so what we want people to be able to do is access really rigorous, clinically informed information so that they can self-advocate and go to their health professionals and seek the right support. Because ADHD is different. It's a developmental difference that needs to have had some evidence of being present, not necessarily impacting on somebody's ability to, you know, be successful on, I hate that word, but on, you know, normal terms. Yeah. But it needs to be evident for a diagnosis. So that's my take on things at the moment anyway. I think we're seeing a cacophony of all sorts of changes and people looking for answers to want to be better.
Mm. And so when we think about neurodiversity, that's a term that I've only really started hearing in the last few years. I sort of came across someone on LinkedIn, I think that they work with neurodivergent people, and I was like, I've never heard that, and sort of started delving into it a little bit. So my take is that I guess all these different things like ADHD, maybe autism, things like that, are things that would maybe fall under the banner of neurodiversity. Is that how you would view that?
Yeah.
How do you look at that?
Yeah. So I guess from a literature perspective and from a social movement perspective, we can kind of think of it in a few different ways. Judy Singer, who's an Australian sociologist, is often referenced as being the woman who coined neurodiversity and brought it into the world. And certainly she did from an academic perspective, but there's a lot of reference to talks that were happening prior to her, you know, coining of the term. So this has been a conversation that's been happening since I think the mid to late 90s. And neurodiversity as a social movement really came about from neurodivergent people. So to your point, people with brain-based differences where there's that developmental trajectory. So somebody who is born with a brain-based difference like autism, like OCD, like, ADHD, that I've lost my train of thought. Speaking of ADHD, ADHD in action. Feel free to leave that in because that's does happen. Yeah. Sometimes I think to myself, am I actually? Yes, I am. So you've got the neurodivergent profiles. So neurodiversity as a social movement was more about taking away that medical pathologizing, if you like, and the idea that there must be something wrong with an autistic person or an ADHD person, the focus on changing them and helping them to be in a neurotypical world by neurotypical standards. So that's it as a social movement. Then neurodiversity as a term actually can refer to the fact that we are as a community of people and humans living on the earth when you're diverse. So just like, you know, there's biodiversity, there's lots of different trees and plants and animals and nature in the world, that human brains are diverse. So I guess there's the social reference, and then there's the collective reference to all of us. When you're talking about, you know, the community of people who then sit within that smaller group, so the 20% representation, we think, of all of those collective neurodevelopmental differences, that's when you're talking about neurodivergence. So neurodivergence, if you like, is like the plural for neurodivergent people. Yeah. That's the way I think of it anyway. And so if you're referring to an individual, it's that they're neurodivergent. Does that help?
That does actually.
Even I get a little bit tripped up sometimes. Yeah, and it is changing. Like, people are changing the language all the time. So it's a tricky landscape to play in.
Yeah. So if you were referring to someone that's neurodivergent, you're talking most likely about someone that has been diagnosed with something, or someone that has something that could actually have a formal diagnosis.
Yes.
Neurodiverse is thinking more about how we all are different. We all have different ways of thinking, the way we function, the way probably feeds in a lot to personality and those sorts of things, and the way that we all think and perceive the world differently.
Beautiful. And then to add to that, the neurodiversity movement is that strengths-based approach to recognizing that neurodivergent people aren't something to be fixed or pathologized.
Yeah. Down syndrome.
Yeah.
Does that sit, would that be considered within the neurodivergent, or is that sort of sitting?
Good question. My answer to that would be, it depends who you ask. And a lot of the profiles, that there is some heated debate, which I also find incredibly curious from a, you know, social psychology perspective, but there's a lot of debate as to what we should consider to be neurodivergent. So Down syndrome, the debate sits between, well, are we talking about a physical difference, or are we talking about a cognitive brain-based difference? And those who say yes, it sits within the neurodivergent profile, would suggest that yes, Down syndrome people have really unique biologically brain-based differences that fit within the neurodivergent community, and there's a whole host of physical differences. And I guess for me, personally, if you're asking my personal opinion, I would say, well, all of the neurodivergent profiles, the focus has for a long time been on brain-based differences. And yet actually we've got very sensitive and different nervous systems that show up in really unique ways that are categorically similar. So an ADHD person's nervous system is very interest-based, for example. An autistic person's nervous system is really acutely attuned to the environment around it, as is ADHD. And so, you know, for somebody with Down syndrome, I would say, well, once we start to move towards a better understanding, I think, of our holistic integration of body, mind, brain, spirit, our nervous system, and how all of that works in its unique ways, I think possibly the arguments might start to calm down a little bit. There's other profiles, for example, like bipolar. That's another one that people have asked. I know Nancy Doyle, if anybody's really curious to sort of dig into the latest research, has sort of tried to chart or map the different types of neurodivergent profiles and how they sit in terms of their recognition historically, as, for example, behavior-based neurodivergent profiles, acquired-based neurodivergent profiles. So somebody, for example, with a traumatic brain injury would be considered acquired neurodivergent. So I can share that paper with you. I don't know. At the end of the day, it's like we started the conversation saying language really matters. And then I sort of think, if we strip all that back, you know, the point of a label for me is really only helpful to help somebody understand and pinpoint what the goal of self-discovery and self-development is that they want to work towards for their self-actualization, and or what the point of the pain and suffering is that they want to put their thumb down on to be able to really, really move the needle on.
Yeah.
I guess that's just my personal standpoint though.
Yeah. I think language, like lots of things, it's powerful and positive to the point that it serves you. And then once it reaches the point that it no longer serves you and it becomes a box and all this stuff, that's the point then it's like, okay, it's tipped too far, or I'm out of whack with it.
Yeah.
It's the same with systems, like the human systems that we create. Like they are designed to serve us. And once they no longer serve us, that's when we need to change them. And so
I love that.
Use it and whatever works until it doesn't work, right?
I love that. Absolutely. And I think if we all applied that thinking, we would progress a lot more as a species rather than boxing ourselves in on our rigid beliefs. So well done. Thank you for bringing the spirit of science to the conversation, Alex.
Man, my high school science teacher would be amazed.
Shout out to your high school science teacher.
He wouldn't know who I was. I slept through the whole class. I'll go down my rabbit holes. So I talk a bit about how school didn't work for me. I left year 10. I did a trade first and then moved my way through different industries. But my memories of science, because I was in the class that they lumped together all the no hopes. And we were sort of like, so I was in this class. And so the whole class was spent the whole time, the teacher just trying to wrangle all the kids that wouldn't do anything. I was sort of in this space where I didn't have the intellectual, like I wasn't sitting in the smart kids, but I wasn't in the naughty kids. I was just the quiet kid who was in this class that they had given up on. And so he would put up a slide on the board and he'd say, all right, everyone write out this paragraph. I'm not changing it until everyone's written it. And so I would sit there, I'd write out the paragraph, and then I sit there while he fights with the rest of the class trying to get them to actually do something. And so I just used to sleep. So I'll just nap through that class and nap away. So now I'm like, you. I'm like, how and why did I get onto this? But but all of those examples of how these things play out and stuff.
Thank you for sharing that. My heart pangs for that little version of you and all of those little versions. I think our educational systems really do struggle. I'm a big fan of Scott Barry Kaufman's work. He speaks a lot to a community that I'm very passionate about, the Twice Exceptional community, where you've got both giftedness and you've got neurodivergent differences. And what's really clear in the literature is depending on where you're identified and where I think sometimes there's those middle groups that kind of get thrown into the, I don't know what to do with you kind of category. I really hope it wasn't the no hope category, but it's where they go, ugh. It's like there's a sense of potential there and yet there's a barrier and that barrier hasn't been identified. And the research really clearly shows if the giftedness is picked up first, then a young person is oftentimes thrown into that high potential trajectory, which was the case for me. If the neurodivergent difference or developmental disorder is picked up first, then they're thrown into what used to be called in Australia special education. And that pathway can make such a difference to somebody's identity, to their, you know, perceptions and beliefs of what they're capable of. We got a lot of work to do, I think, in our education system to recognize individual differences and to really double down on how we can help people activate their curiosity, regardless of how they do that. It's a wicked challenge, I think, but one worth looking at. So thanks for sharing.
That's like someone can do a whole actual podcast on that, not just one episode, as in their whole show is about that. So I was keen to the brain's biological base. What is our brain's biological base, and then how does that then look different for different people?
You really did do some good research. Are you referring to the article I wrote on ADHD flow and
yeah.
Okay, good. Just for context. So I think in that particular article, which we might link in the show notes, I was talking to one of the things I really love to do in my spare time, because I'm that kind of person, is to find gaps in literature and try and plug them in with ideas or hypotheses. And I don't necessarily then go out and do the testing myself. I hope somebody else will do it. But one of the gaps that I've found really curious in two parts of research that I love to take a look at, one is creativity and flow. And then the other, and what are the sort of biological basis of how people are naturally more inclined to get into flow, and then which is neuroscience, and then obviously ADHD and the overlap between the two. Mm. And what I found really curious was the gap in the literature, in the sense that we understand a lot of the brain-based differences and we can scan those in MRIs,
for people with ADHD and how they respond, for example, to stimulant medication versus a non-ADHD brain. And then on the other side, we understand from an MRI and neuroscience and brain-based evidence what happens in the brain of somebody who demonstrates the outcomes of creativity and flow, or when they're reporting they're in a flow state. And where the gap is that for some reason, those two things haven't seemed to be connected. So in my reading and my take, what's really interesting is in an ADHD brain, for example, it's a part of the brain that Scott Barry Kaufman has started calling, or has been calling, the imagination network, but it's called the default mode network. And in a neurotypical brain, it comes on in those shower moments, or when somebody is just sort of partially daydreaming, or when they're about to go to sleep, but it's more in that relaxed state. And in that neuronormative or neurotypical brain, there's another part of the brain that kind of acts like a switch called the salience network. And it switches really nicely. It acts like an accelerator and a brake between the imagination network or that daydream state over to then the executive functioning aspects of our brain that help us with decision-making, with task execution. What's really interesting in an ADHD brain is that that salience network, or the brake, the accelerator system between the default mode network and the executive functions, doesn't seem to operate as well. How that relates to flow and creativity is that the default mode network is what we actually need to activate, or what gets activated when we're moving into flow. It's also the part of the brain that's activated for free association, for example. So there's some really cool studies that have been done around jazz improvisation artists, rappers, and how they are able to access just that brilliance in their creativity. And it is through that activation, or that heightened performance of the default mode network. So when I'm talking about understanding our brain-based biology, I'm seeing a future where we can really get to understand what our different kind of cognitive profiles are from that strengths and struggles perspective, so that we can lean in and leverage our strengths that we were born with more readily and through a more, I guess, informed lens. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about brain-based biology. It's recognizing that our brains are uniquely wired. They have unique ways of distributing neurotransmitters. They have unique ways of talking to our nervous systems, for example. And when we get to understand that, that's when we can really personalize our, you know, performance-based protocols, our psychology protocols, all of our health and well-being protocols, to not just, you know, be well, but to really thrive as well.
Yeah. Do you have an idea in your mind what that would look like practically? Say if you were applying that idea to yourself,
yeah,
what that would end up practically looking like?
Yeah, tell me more about that question, because it went for a few different options.
If you're applying that thing, and I'm still processing that information, but say
it was a lot.
You've come to an idea of the brain's biological base, and you've maybe there's different profiles that have been created out of that, or something. That then you, based on the research that's been done around that, you can now see that I am XYZ profile.
Yeah, you're on it. So this is me future predicting, right? Future forecasting. So we're not there yet.
Yeah.
But it's a space that I'm really enjoying playing in and designing around. I see a future where, similar to how we developed, or Chris Peterson, for example, and Seligman designed the character, character strengths, and virtues, that we can kind of map universally those 24 character strengths. And there are other profiles as well. Gallup has got their own strength profile, or how we've done personality testing. We understand the big five. I can see a future as we get more interested, curious, and invested in understanding neurodiversity, understanding neurodivergent brains. I can see a future where we'll start to say, oh, cool. So you've got this diagnosis of ADHD, which is normally where the conversation stops, by the way, not helpful. You've got this diagnosis of ADHD. That means that you're born with a brain that does X, Y, Z, but we're just going to check out if that's you. So we're going to run some tests. We're going to run some experiments. We're going to track you over time. And we're going to iterate together and play with these performance-based protocols that we think are probably matched to your neurotype, because they tend to match to 95% of people with a neurotype like yours.
Yeah.
So, you know, with all of our tests, strengths, personalities. Nothing is 100%, and that's why it's science.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see a future where the more we invest in understanding brain biology, understanding that integrated system of self, the better we'll get at highly personalized interventions.
Mm. Yeah.
So I guess I treat myself as a case study and a guinea pig, one of one, right?
And that would be an amazing place to get to, because I find all those different, like, and then there's, you know, like quizzes that you can do to give you a good indicator, and they're the sorts of things you always take them with a grain of salt, and that's what it's a great way that it really helps me when I'm just sitting and trying to think and reflect and how can I keep growing. Those sorts of things I find really helpful. Like, I've done one where it's like I'm a thinker feeler personality type out of thinker feeler doer.
Yeah.
I've sort of leaned to like a thinker feeler. And that for me, and I'm like, okay, that's a really great concept. That's something I can think about, and it frames something for me to think, this is how can I lean into those strengths. Or another I'm working with improving my eating habits and this sort of stuff. And I did one quiz and it came back that I'm an all or nothing personality, which explains why I'll be going really well for 6 months and then there's a shift and then I'm like, oh, I fumbled. Now I'm just eating crap every day for the next 6 months because I can't turn it around. And then I get back on the track. And so then it's like, all right, that gives me a framework for, okay, I'm aware of that. That's actually not an ideal place to be sitting. How can I sort of try and smooth that out a bit? And so that would be amazing for people that instead of just getting, oh, you've got ADHD. And it's like, cool, what do I do with that?
Yeah.
Oh, you're falling into this bracket. These are the strengths that you might commonly exude, and these are the things that you could really lean into. Also, this might be the potential downside of those strengths. Here's how you can maybe navigate those a bit better.
You got it.
Help you really lean into your strengths in a way that's productive and positive.
Yeah. And I guess for me, what really excites me about the idea of looking at this through physical data, so looking more at our advances in neuroscience and being able to pick up on those genetic markers, is that up until now, you know, a lot of those tests that you've sort of alluded to, they rely on self-report, which relies on self-awareness, which relies on a part of our brain in our executive function system that for neurodivergent people looks different. And the other thing is that a lot of the, you know, psychology tests, a lot of the personality tests that have been developed have been wrapped around very limited samples. I hate to say it, but those samples tend to have been male-based, male-dominated, westernized in their culture, and neurotypical. So a lot of the work that I'm doing now with neurodivergent leaders who are kind of going through these leadership programs going, they're asking for these behaviors that are actually, to me, feel really unsafe. I'm having to mask to be the kind of leader that this leadership protocol says I need to be. It's because they weren't built for brains like ours. And so where I can see our future moving is that rather than relying on self-report, that we will use that as one piece, but we'll actually be able to measure, you know, how much dopamine is being released in your brain, how much serotonin is being released in your brain, what part of your brain actually fires up naturally at best and under what conditions, and what part of your brain is kind of struggling to fire up, and what's the consequence of that? How can we leverage the part of your brain that fires really naturally to be able to act as a strength? Or how do we partner you with somebody who's got that part of their brain that fires really naturally so that you can do the thing that you were meant to be doing in the world?
Yeah.
That's where I can see the future headed.
That
more multidisciplinary.
Yeah. And then that, like, if that science started to really emerge, that's then something that goes beyond just neurodivergent people. That is something that's
for everybody.
Becomes a hack for humanity.
Absolutely. But this is where, you know, this is where I always remind people, if you look at the positive psychology movement, which is an act for everybody, if you like, it came out of Martin Seligman's realization that for so long we had focused with psychology on the clinical aspects of suffering. Now, that's not to say that suffering's not important and that suffering's not, you know, an experience of the human condition. It is. Of course, it's really important that we understand that. But if we don't then understand that functioning to flourishing space, we're missing out. Same with neurodivergence. If we start to look at the unique presentations of our brains and how they show up and really start to pay attention to those, in my opinion, that gives a gift to everybody to be able to say, hey, so as neurodivergent people, we might not have this thing that you neurotypical people have, but hey, guess what? you neurotypicals over there, you could learn a little bit from us about what it means to get into a creative flow state. And what would it look like if we actually worked together?
Yeah.
Rather than being so divisive.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this has naturally moved into the space of the workplace, and I'm keen to bring this conversation into the workplace. How do leaders design neuro-inclusive workplaces? How do we go about bridging that gap?
Big question. It's the next big thing, and it's about time, I say. Big question. Like, you know, that's my entire body of work. Let me give your listeners three things to think about. We know really confidently from the research that there are three psychological climates of safety that are really important for workplaces to be doubling down on if they want to create neuro-inclusive spaces. And what's interesting is when a company approaches me to do some work, whether it be a keynote or workshop or to come and do a bigger consulting piece, which is my favorite piece, they tend to start at step three, which is around policies and procedures. And I say, whoa, let's take a backtrack. Because actually for those policies and procedures and the things that you put on paper, for them to be impactful and effective, we need to think about the other two conditions. And the other two conditions, the first psychological climate is around perceived visibility, is a word I like to use. They've got fancy psychobabble words, but I'll refer to the paper for readers who are interested in that. But visibility. So if I'm going into an organization, can I see other ADHD people? And can I, are they celebrated? Can I see them across the landscape of the organization? So, you know, I want to be able to see ADHD people who are working on the floor. I want to see people in the shop that I'm going to go working to, but I want to see them in my leadership teams too. And then once I can see, so that's really about disclosure, once I can see that culture of safety from a visibility perspective, then the second piece is, well, where do we hang out? And this is the climate around belonging. So different to needing to fit in, Brené Brown's doing a lot of beautiful work around this. Belonging says, I can be who I am and have a space to feel safe around that. So neurodivergent people struggle a lot in workplaces that are designed for neurotypical workers to thrive. The environmental aspects of lighting, of you know, the ways that we set our workplaces up, these open spaces, the noise, the disruptions, often rattle our nervous systems. And so we have to mask, we have to sort of arm up. And so that belonging piece gives us a space in an organization to say, okay, I know where my people are at because I can see them. But then there are also opportunities for us to come together and for us to talk about the change that we want, what's working well, where we want to move the needle. There's a space for us to celebrate our days and recognize that we've still got some work to do around awareness. And once you've got that piece, we can start to talk about policies and procedures, because that third piece for safety around policies and procedures really needs to have the voices of the people that it's going to impact, and that's your neurodivergent community. So workplaces, I'm so excited to be contributing at this point in time off the back of the incredible work that's already been done by academics and allies and activists before me, because we're in a point in history, I believe, where workplaces are starting to recognize that it's not just the right thing to do to create a neuro-inclusive workplace, but to your point, when we double down on the conditions for thriving that support neurodivergent professionals, we actually support everybody. So while it's really helpful for and important and integral for neurodivergent people, actually everybody benefits from low demand, you know, sensory sensitive, explicit communication changes, you know, the psychological safety where people can be themselves. Yeah. Everybody benefits from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I always think about a lot of these things, not this specifically to this conversation, but just when we're thinking about organizations in general, like, and targets and things that we have, like culture needs to precede the KPIs and the more hardline things. Like, you need to actually build a culture, and a culture being people's actual behaviors, not just our ideal vision or some word that we've chucked out there that we don't actually do. We just say we do it. Like the culture of the organization needs to be that then creates the policies and the KPIs that follow it. So it doesn't become some blanket number, we're going to hire five people with ADHD, you know, and it's like,
that's right. Well, the tick the box inclusion policy that I hate. Absolutely.
And then we're going to hire five more next year because all of these ones quit because they hated it.
Yeah. And it's so interesting because there's a real, you probably have read, especially in the States at the moment, there's a real pushback against diversity inclusion initiatives and equity initiatives, and people are very upset about that and for very good reasons.
Yeah.
But I think if we pull all of that apart and we just think, well, what's the common humanity piece? And if we're going to lose these structures or these, you know, these activist places and spaces in our workplaces for a period of time, because I don't think it will be forever, it can come back to those simple principles of unless and until you recognize and double down on the fact that your people matter and they need to matter in order to perform and to produce the services and the products and the solutions that you want to give the world through profit and then make profit from them. Until you double down on that mattering, you've got a really unhealthy, toxic workforce that probably isn't going to pay your bills anyway.
Yeah. And it gets back to the language conversation.
Yeah,
so
it does.
DEI, like, so because I was just listening to a podcast the other day and it was talking about DEI and how that term and stuff is now sort of got all these connotations and so it needs to sort of be going through another rebrand, which it was really the term that was starting to replace HR and sort of had HR and it sort of became people and culture and then it was a DEI.
People experience.
And it'll be another name. But it's like and changing those things in the language, like we said, it does matter. But also it's not the only thing that matters. And so it's like, yes, change the language if people now have negative connotations with it. But don't just do the same thing.
And don't forget the core of why the language is there in the first place. And again, it comes back to recognizing that we're people and people need to connect and they're demanding to connect and they're demanding dignity. Which is why the work you're doing, Alex, is it's really important in the world. It really is. And your listeners are very important for listening into these conversations too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking where I want to keep taking it because there's so many channels we could keep going down. I'm just thinking, before we move into a deep dive on creativity, just thinking like practical things for someone that say...
practical. Yes, let's do that.
They've identified... You know, maybe they identify as ADHD or some type of neurodivergent brain.
Yeah.
They're at work. How do they approach this? Like maybe some are in positive environment, some are in a negative. How do they navigate? What's some things they can do to keep achieving their career goals that they have?
I love practical. There's so much that people can do. If you haven't already, found yourself a really good ADHD coach, do that. And I guess I'm just speaking to ADHD specifically, but the same applies to all of our different neurodivergent profiles. Find a coach anyway, a neuroaffirming coach. But I really think that taking what you can find on the Internet of Things in terms of protocols and working with somebody who can be a mirror and reflect the progress to you. A lot of the time, those of us with brain-based differences, what we struggle with, our working memory and our tendency to also to chase the next shiny thing means that we can lack the discipline that it takes to have the craft of reflection. And it's that reflection that helps you to see the progress. So I would definitely say if you haven't already, if you're in a position that you can, find a coach and or a mentor and or a sponsor. The sponsor is a little bit different from a mentor. A sponsor will really be the person who puts you in the room and says that you need a seat at the table because you deserve one. If you're not familiar with those terms, have a look at those. The other thing that I would say, if you're in a workplace as an employee and you're in Australia, a lot of people are unfamiliar with the offering that Job Access has. It's our government initiative for people living with disabilities, of which brain-based differences fall under that category. So under the EAF, which is Employee Assistant Funding, you can work with your employer to get access to, I think it's like $1,600 worth of one-to-one coaching, which can go a pretty long way over a year. Access to training within the workplace. You can get access to all sorts of modifications to support your disability. My tip on that type of process in terms of the practical, what can you do, is if you are the type of person with a brain-based difference who's hearing this and going, all of this is too hard and I don't know where to start and I'm overwhelmed, work with an advocate or an ally. Now, that advocate or ally could be a friend or a family member, but we've also got disability advocates in Australia who are really well placed to be able to help you move through some of the paperwork, move through some of the applications that, again, unfortunately, just weren't built with our neurodivergent brains in mind. And then in terms of, you know, the fun stuff that I love to play with, psychology and performance-based protocols to really move from functioning to flourishing, that I like to think of that as a unique work-life design that every individual gets to do. So my place in the world is always about saying, hey, here's a massive big toolkit, but you come in and you choose what you're going to add into yours. You know, how do you personalize this to make it work for you? So I'm really excited to be pressing play on an ebook at the moment. It's about 25 performance-based protocols that are going to help neurodivergent people thrive in 2025. So people can download that directly from my website. And it's come about from interviewing lots of neurodivergent professionals who have been really generous in sharing their unique leadership journey, you know, some of the lessons that they've learned from the unnecessary suffering they've had, moving out of burnout, but then also moving into creating routines, workflows, and energy mapping that helps them to really honor their unique nervous systems and thrive. So hopefully there's a few practical takeaways that are helpful.
No, that's really good. And it's funny, at the time of recording, the episode hasn't released, but I just interviewed Gillian Fox the other day.
Oh,
and,
amazing.
And she really focused on the sponsor piece because, like, right. I often talk about mentors, coaches, and leaders. And she brought up about sponsors, and I was like, I haven't actually heard about this in the career context. And she was just talking about, like, of all of them, it's probably the most important. It's not just a mentor who's going to, like, give you some advice. It's someone that's actually going to actively advocate for you in the workplace to
absolutely.
Say, vouch for you, and be like,
yeah.
No, this person is worth sticking with, working with, elevating. Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Makes a massive difference, especially for our minority groups, people who have traditionally sort of been sat on the outside. The sponsor piece is huge. I've had the privilege of having informal sponsors in my life that have opened up doors that I couldn't possibly have imagined nudging myself. Not because I'm not capable of nudging them, but for the minority reasons of why I do the work I do. And I consider myself to be quite a privileged minority member, I have to say. So yeah, I've certainly seen sponsorship, and I've been a sponsor to others. And it's a two-way meaningful exchange. You know, there's mutual benefit. If you're somebody who is in a position of power or someone that's further ahead that can see the possibility and the potential in a colleague or in a friend, you know, be that person that says, hey, let's pull up a seat because you've got something really important to say. So that there's both those pieces. A shout out to a friend of mine, actually, for your listeners, Natalie Phillips Mason, who does a lot of really beautiful work in allyship for neurodivergent people. She speaks a lot about the different skills, the different mindsets, and challenging some assumptions for allies so that they can really support our community as well.
That's really good. Look, Maz, I think we're just going to have to put it down that we're going to have to do a part two.
I love that. I love part twos.
you and I could talk for hours. I'm a busy person, but we'll find a day that it works again in 2025 maybe to keep chatting. We can and deep dive into creativity and all of those things. But thank you so much. How can people find you, get in touch with you, work with you?
Oh, first of all, you're very welcome. I could talk to you for hours. I love a riff like this. I hope your listeners have too. You can find me, on the Internet of Things. I'm probably most active on LinkedIn at the moment. I'm picking up on Instagram, I must admit. But LinkedIn and Instagram, it's my personal handle, so Marianne Power. Or you can head over to my website, mariannepower.com.au. And find my own podcast, Classroom 5.0, where I'm having conversations with neurodivergent professionals to really dive into this question of what it takes to thrive with brain-based differences.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Go take your dog for a walk.
I will, down to the beach today.
Have a wonderful Christmas as well, even though this will probably release after Christmas.
You too, Alex. It's so lovely to catch up. Thank you. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And let's connect on LinkedIn so that we can keep the conversation going.
Or head to my website and download my free resource, The Career Building Principles. Bye for now.